This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places and the poems of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Let's go to the phones.
Tribe Poets Hotline, Brian speaking. I'll be your poet for tonight. What do you need a poem about?
Well, the possibilities are endless. The Pride Poets Hotline is a phone-in hotline during LGBTQ Pride Month, where you call in and a team of poets will write you a custom poem right on the spot. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo recently shadowed one of the hotline's poets and is here to tell us all about it. Hi, Danielle.
Hey there, Steve.
So a poetry hotline, I mean, it sounds, you know, as quick and easy as ordering a pizza. Is that what it's all about?
Steve, this is the artsy-fartsy creative hotline of your dreams, where you can call in and they write you a poem right on the spot. They're a collective of LGBTQ plus artists who've been taken to the phone lines every Pride Month for the last 3 years. And many of them are based right here in LA, including Brian Sonia Wallace. He's the current poet laureate of West Hollywood, and that was him on the phone just now. He lives and breathes poetry, Steve. And as you mentioned, I shadowed him on a recent Saturday night. And when I say Saturday night, I mean late Saturday, from about 11 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Ooh, 2 a.m. That's the middle of the night.
It sure is. So around 10:30 p.m., I rolled up to Brian's low-key, nondescript West Hollywood apartment. His spot is just steps away from Santa Monica Boulevard, where that night you could hear all the drunken and beautiful debauchery of the L.A. Pride madness. And the next thing I know, I'm camping out in his undeniably messy room and settle down onto his disheveled, unmade bed. Typewriters and piles of books and clothes are scattered all over the floor, and it's hot as hell inside. To set the mood, he set up some candles and rainbow twinkle lights, and a mason jar full of whiskey sits to the left of his beautiful black Remington Rand typewriter. Brian is ready for the night of nonstop poetry. And speaking of the poems, in total, the Pride Poets took more than 200 calls from folks all around that day. And get this, Steve, an anonymous donor actually teamed up with the Pride Poets and contributed $15 for every call they got. Meaning, in total, they raised some $3,000, with all proceeds going to the LA LGBT Center. But anyway, Steve, are you ready to hear some poems?
I'm ready to hear some poems.
Awesome. So first up is Jessica, who called in around 11, right as Brian first logged on to take calls.
Pride Poets Hotline, Brian speaking. I'll be your poet for tonight. What do you need a poem about?
Hi, Brian. How about a blanket?
How about a blanket? I could do a blanket poem. Tell me more about this blanket. You need a poem about a blanket. Tell me why.
Well, I have some mental health issues, and I kind of describe depression as living under a hot, wet blanket, and it's kind of hard to stand from, you know, to stand up when you're living under a hot, wet blanket. So I thought that it would be a good time to call about something a little bit happier.
So from depression blanket to comfort blanket.
Yeah.
Can you, like, what is this blanket made out of? How old is it? How did you get this blanket? Like, tell me all the things.
The blanket is small. And I'm going to say a little bit newer. It's clean. And I'm going to say I got it for myself.
Okay, let me see what I can do with that. The blanket is small. Cool. You'll hear some typing sounds, and I'll let you know when I have your poem.
Okay. Sounds good.
And just 5 minutes later.
All right, Jessica. Can I read it to you?
Yeah, please.
This is for Jessica. The blanket is small. I got it for myself before I rested, before I knew what rest was, before I was all woven and heavy, sodden with my own sweat, wondering what this fool life was for. I wrap myself in my insecurities. Call these comfort. My failures, my teachers, my dearest ones, my chosen family, come in messy. Bedraggled, come in hopeless. I've made the bed. Stay as long as you need. The blanket is small. it will still fit all of us. There are so many under it, smoking weed and making calls and longing for daybreak. The blanket is small, but it is mine. For you.
That is awesome.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
So, Steve, there's one more poem I want you to hear. This is for a man named Renee, who called in around 12:30.
Pride Poets Hotline, Brian speaking. I'll be your poet for tonight. What do you need a poem about?
Ambition.
Ambition. I love it. Is that something that you're looking to have more of? Is that something are you manifesting that with this poem? Are you calming that down with this poem? What's your relationship with ambition at the moment?
More trying to manifest momentum. I'm just re-entering my acting career after 30 years.
Cool.
So need to figure out, be able to sort of gather the spirits to move me forward.
If I was like a casting director and you were like, this is my type, what's your type as a character?
Generally, it's sort of the dad, the haphazard dad.
Cool. Haphazard dad. And what with that ambition, what are you hoping to accomplish? What's the goal?
I'd like to continue telling LGBT stories, but now from a dad perspective versus come out many, many, many years ago. So being able to be a supportive father, encouraging people to sort of find their way. My old coworkers' kids, people who around the country who happen to know that I'm gay and don't know how to deal with their kids. So they.
Do you have a piece of advice that you feel like you keep coming back to?
I think mostly just to open their heart and really listen to what they're saying and not what you're thinking about what they're saying.
If this poem had a setting, where would it be? Would it be like on a mountaintop? Would it be underwater? Would it be on the living room couch?
It would be at the Cheesecake Factory. Casual.
Done. I got it. Okay. I'll let you know when I have your poem.
Good luck with that.
All right.
And so, 3 minutes later?
All right, Renee. Oh, thank you for that. Can I read it to you?
Sure.
Haphazard dad at the Cheesecake Factory pays for everyone on the sly, drops wisdom like nachos, and cleans up plates usually after people are done. See that hunger? Haphazard dad is a junkyard of like new dreams. Expectations beat down by life but still chugging along, getting decades old mileage. We've seen this road before. It's not so scary. There's cheesecake on the other side. Strawberry. Don't be afraid. Gay is haphazard, a messy palace, a dining hall with space for everyone.
Amen.
Amen. Let it be. Oh, thank you so much, Renee.
You're my hugger.
By the way, if you're hungry for more poetry, Brian Sonia Wallace holds a weekly poetry open mic over at Mickey's in West Hollywood on Tuesdays from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m.
KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo. Thank you so much, Danielle. Great story.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, coming up, dialing into a family history, new author Sean Amos talks about growing up in a cookie empire, being and then raising a kid of divorce, and his love of music. It's all yours after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Giotakis. Back in the 1970s, when Hollywood's Sunset Strip was home to, well, quite a few vices, a talent agent named Wallace Amos Jr., his friends knew him as Wally, bought a rundown A-frame storefront loaded up on flour and chocolate chips and began a business. His cookie store, which he called Famous Amos, would become one of the most beloved in America. But as Amos's star rose, his ex-wife's flickered. Shirley Ellis, a beauty queen and nightclub singer known as Shirley May, was privately struggling with severe mental illness. Well, Shirley and Wally's witness was their son, Sean Amos. And Sean is a blues musician based here in L.A. known as the Reverend Sean Amos. He's just published his debut novel, Cookies and Milk, which is loosely based on his childhood and his own experience of fatherhood. Reverend, welcome to Greater L.A.
Great to be with you. Great to be with you. I'm a big fan of the show.
You're not really a reverend, are you?
I'm a mail order reverend. So, you know, the magic of the internet and Universal Life Church, and there you go, only in America.
You are, however, a chocolate chip cookie connoisseur, aficionado, as it were, expert.
That is real.
Cookies and Milk follows a young kid named Ellis as he helps his dad open a cookie store in Hollywood. Obviously, this is your story as well. It is fiction, though. It's loosely autobiographical. You've been holding on to the story about your family and Famous Amos for decades now. What inspired you to finally write a book about it?
A couple things. I'd written about my childhood in less glowing terms for Huffington Post serialization years ago. And it was also called Cookies and Milk. And it talked about the vices of Sunset Boulevard that you mentioned and talked about my father's challenges and my mother's challenges. And it was not a happy, child-friendly piece. And that was sort of the lens through which I'd gotten used to talking about my childhood. And I was really getting bored of that lens. And then the second thing was my own divorce, where I became a bit estranged from my son, whose name is Ellis in reality. And I was spending a lot of time thinking about the pattern of divorce in my family and fatherhood and black fatherhood. And in the midst of that, I began to sort of retrace my memories of the cookie store, which I realized were really joyful. That spot was a real safe haven for me, and it really inoculated me from a lot of the pain that existed elsewhere. And so I wanted to write a story about my childhood from a point of view of joy versus pain. And I wanted to give my father, who now has dementia, and my son something that they could hold on to.
And by the way, it should be underscored that this is a children's book, right? This is not, I mean, it's obviously semi, quasi autobiographical, but it's also meant to address children.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a middle grade novel. So the intended audience are 8-year-olds to 12-year-olds. But in my mind, I wrote it with two audiences in mind. I wrote it for fathers who perhaps are of the same era I am from, but fathers in general, and for those kids 8 to 12. It's really, I sort of had one eye on each audience.
Early in this book, we learn that Ellis's parents are recently divorced. It's the summer before sixth grade. He kind of resents his dad for dragging him into the cookie business. You can certainly relate to that. I mean, how closely does that mirror your own family story? Did you resent getting into the cookie? I mean, look, we all kind of resent some of the things that our parents do, right?
Yeah, it's fine. I resented having to share him. And the store was a mixed bag in that when we were getting the store ready, and it's written really true to form. I mean, the places are run down. It was a House of Pies. Listeners may remember the House of Pies.
There's still one in Los Feliz, a House of Pies. Yeah.
There's one, I think it's the last one on Vermont, right?
On Vermont.
But there's a chain of them, and then it was a pinball joint, and it was this rundown, grimy place, and the two of us were literally the only ones in there cleaning it out. And that was lovely, but as the place opened, I mean, it was an immediate hit, and I had to share him with a lot of folks. And so having lost him to divorce and then losing him again through all this, adulation he was getting, that was a bummer. But I love that store, man. I learned so many life lessons that I still apply in that store. I stood on milk crates like I write in the book, and worked at the cash register. I still run into people who came into that store, and some of them I probably served cookies as a kid. It was a bit of a mixed bag for me, and that I don't know if it in reality drew me any closer to him. But it certainly gave me an environment where I could feel safe, and where I could safely learn about things. I could safely be exposed to people who I might not want to be exposed to outside of that store.
the store notwithstanding, I mean, how is Wally as a dad?
He was a mixed bag. I think, like a lot of dads are, particularly that generation. He was a Black man who was, began his career in the 60s during segregation. I think you mentioned at the outset that he was a talent agent. He was the first Black agent at the William Morris Agency. He was the first Black agent in the business. Happened to be at William Morris. He booked all the Motown acts. He booked Simon and Garfunkel, The Animals, some of the British Invasion bands. And he ultimately left William Morris because they wouldn't promote him to head of the music department, because they didn't think that the other agents would take kindly to working under a Black guy. So, This is a guy who, like many of his peers, was, trying to break the chains of segregation and trying to integrate a lot of, the industries. And he was a hustler, like I think I am to some degree. I think I've inherited that, like certainly his peers are. And that came first. I think fatherhood was truly, an afterthought. So he wasn't present. And we were all, I don't know how old you are, but I think everyone my age, sort of prides themselves on being this latchkey kid, generation.
Early 50s, I get it. No, absolutely, latchkey.
Yeah, man.
In front of the TV, parents not home. Yeah.
No one was around. I mean, no one was around. So it's not necessarily unique to me or my circumstance, but you have sort of a Black man looking to make it. You've got the 1970s. You've got a bit of celebrity entrepreneurship, and all that together does not make for a present parenthood.
You mentioned your dad has dementia, right?
He does. Yeah,
he's in his 80s. Is he still somehow involved in the business? I mean, you're still making cookies.
No, not at all. Not at all. His dementia is pretty far along. He lost the company. I mean, and this is another reason why I wrote the book, right? Because so much of my father's biography now is, at least for anyone who somewhat knows his story, understands his downfall. I mean, he lost his company. He lost his fortune. He had multiple failed attempts at trying to make a comeback. Some of them were a bit embarrassing in my view. I got used to sort of that sad fall as being part of his narrative. And certainly I have half siblings. My father was married, multiple times, and we're all really close. And we all gotten used to talking about all the ways in which he screwed things up, and almost like diminishing his accomplishments. But what he did was remarkable, and he has a brand that's still there. And he was a Black face of a business at a time when there were virtually none. But he did lose it, and he's living comfortably in Hawaii right now, where he moved in 1977, and he's being taken care of. And his memory is very much gone. The long goodbye, they call it, dementia. It's definitely a long goodbye.
It's terrible. It's terrible. And you lost your mom. I'm so sorry. In 2003, she died tragically by suicide, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She was severely mentally ill. She had schizoaffective disorder, which is sort of a mix of bipolar or manic depression and schizophrenia. And her illness set in before I was born. And so her career had already ended, and she was very ill from the moment I knew her. I never knew her as a well woman. And she was in and out of hospitals her whole life, and ended up taking her life. And another reason for the book. I've spent so much of my life, Steve, just sort of trying to come to grips and live peacefully with all of the darker stuff that filled my early life. that, now that I'm a father of three, and you think a bit about what you want to leave behind, and I really would love to leave some, clues behind that make my children's life and their journey easier than my own. And so, if those clues can be joyful ones, I'd like to sit in that space for a little bit more than I've sat in it previously.
Would you mind, Sean, reading the dedication of the book for me, for us?
Yeah, you got it. This book is for my son and my father. I stand between you both as the three of us nurse our wounds across generations. This story is the bridge I've built for us. For you, my only son, I hope it provides a light for your way forward. This book is also dedicated to the young boys of all colors, dreaming of the men they hope to become. Keep your eyes and your hearts open. There are clues all around you.
How old is Ellis now?
He is now 16, soon to be 17. So, he's on his way.
Did writing this book reveal anything new to you about your own family or about fatherhood? Have you talked to Ellis about all of this stuff?
He and I are still repairing our relationship. I think we've got a tenuous grasp on each other again after, having let go for a little bit. And I'm grateful for that, but we've got a ways to go still. He's proud of the book. I don't know if he's read the book, to be honest with you, but he's certainly proud of it. I gained a lot of empathy for my father, for sure, writing this thing. I got to relive a lot of my childhood that, frankly, I'd forgotten about, or either consciously or subconsciously, and that was lovely to sort of go back and revisit this time that brought me so much. It was healing. I mean, I cried a lot writing this book. there were a lot of tears shed writing it, and I was just filled with gratitude. I mean, that's sort of the overarching thing that came out of this thing was really, joy and gratitude and having an opportunity to, to see it through a different lens. I was given a lot of gifts. And so, that's the greatest thing that came out of it. But I think, my son's happy to have himself immortalized like any teenage kid would be. So there's a win there.
There's got to be. Yeah, exactly. What a great conversation. I want to thank you. Your debut novel, Cookies and Milk, is obviously out. Now you're going to be reading, by the way, the book at Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena this Saturday at 11 a.m. And we're going to go out, Sean, with one of your tunes called Hollywood Blues. This is Reverend Sean Amos of the Brotherhood. Sean, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, brother.
I looked up, she sat me down. She said, you're gonna need a friend if you expect to stick around. So I got my hat, bought me new shoes. I'm feeling like $1 million in my $20 suit. But I got the blues, I got them Hollywood blues. We all want, but don't forget who you are, the Hollywood Blues. This town is it, but it sure is tough. You know you never get it all, but
that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, the Hollywood Bowl turns 100, a centenarian, can you believe it? A look back at its origin story and its legacy. That's tomorrow on GLA. Check us out anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. Share your thoughts with us. Give us some story ideas. And subscribe to the podcast, too, kcrw.com/GLA. By the way, you can get the podcast anywhere. Just search for Greater LA Podcast, KCRW. Juliana Mayo, Robin Estrin, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamad, Phil Richards, Desmond Taylor, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time. Thanks, of course, for your ear. Have a great day.
One day, you know I will. I got the looks, I got the fights. suckers all will be knocked out when you see my name in lights. I got the blues. I got them Hollywood blues, y'all. We all want to be a star, but don't forget who you are. We all want to be a star, don't forget who you are. We all want to be a star, don't forget who you are. The Hollywood Blues. My Rambler, take a left on Formosa, stop at the Rock and Roll Ralphs, pick up myself a bug over Sunset Grill, wash it down with some cookies and milk over that A-frame store, got that funny hat, going back home, wait for my agent to call. Oh, Hollywood.